Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna.
Det är dags för det femte avsnittet av Hästveterinärerna. Podden för dig som är veterinär eller djursjukskötare och jobbar med hästar. Jag som pratar heter Maria Willemsson. Avsnitt 5 som sagt, men det är också det andra avsnittet där vi ska lyssna på Janet Grau, diplomat i anestesiologi. Om du inte redan har sett dem så kan jag varmt rekommendera de två webbinarierna med Janet på temat smärta som ligger på vetportal.se. Där kan du som veterinär skapa ett konto och få tillgång till våra inspelade webbinars och mycket annat. Vi börjar med att lyssna in på vårt andra samtal med Janet.
I'm here again with Janni, who is going to do the second podcast episode about pain and pain physiology and pain management in horses. Welcome to the podcast again, Janni.
Thank you.
We've been talking a little bit about specific cases in our latest episode, a little bit about foals and severe pain and so on. As we have been recording these sessions and also as I've been watching your webinars, I've been thinking a lot about what options we actually do have in equine medicine, and that the small animal vets seem to have a little bit more options. I mean, when it comes to pain management in the small animal medicine, they also have much more options now compared to like 10, 15 years ago. In the same amount of time, how would you describe the development, our understanding of the equine side when it comes to pain physiology, but also the assessment and the management?
Oh, that's actually a really good question. I also act as an anesthesia and analgesia specialist for small animals. So certainly I feel there's more room there for, there's a bigger toolbox, right? As you indicate, there's drugs out there that we don't have on the equine market. So one of the things that's definitely hampering us is that the food producing animal legislation and the licensing that is required does, I think, put a brake on the release of drugs to the equine market. At the same time, it's also inherent to equine practice that whenever drugs are, so we have had and have seen new drugs come out, which sometimes the even if there are mild adverse effects in horses, because the horse is a large flight animal, a slight behavioral response would be a big thing, right? And we all know that buprenorphine in several studies, but also particularly in clinical practice, people tend to find that these horses get more of the locomotion stimulation than we would typically see with other opioids. So this can sometimes put a brake on your using a drug, which you would gladly embrace because of a specific equine side effect or concern, right? I also think the past 10 to 15 years, I've seen a bit of a reappraisal of opioids in equine practice. That is not to say, you know, opioids are great for any kind of pain. Please put opioids in. That's definitely not the way forward. But I believe some over 20 years ago and back in the 80s and early 90s, many studies were being done on supra maximal dosages of opioids in horses and in healthy, pain-free ones. And then you would see all these side effects like locomotor stimulation. They would be agitated, excited, and there would be many side effects, which, you know, they don't correspond with clinical use in a population of horses that has clinically severe pain, right? So I think there's a reappreciation also of how important a pain state is to a body, and that you cannot infer actions of a drug based on studies in healthy animals and then just extrapolate that to the painful situation. I think that's been a very important realization. And then the other super development in the past decade or decade and a half must have been in pain assessment.
Yeah,
there is so much more formal attention for it. And we have made such progress that at this point, it's not about developing scales. the next challenge is going to be about refining scales so that vets don't need to pick a tool from 10 different developed pain scales, but have an easier choice and of a valid option, right? A validated option. I think that would be our next move. But there's definitely been progress made.
It's just when you compare, it's like, they have the bigger toolbox, as you say, but we do have options as well.
We do. And sometimes some of these options were underutilized in the past, either over, you know, now proven not so valid concerns or over real concerns, but at dosages, which we can also reduce. And sometimes it also depends on local use. So in some countries, levomethadone would be out. In other countries, it's not. In some countries, paracetamol is approved for veterinary use. In others, it's not. So there are these local differences and legislative frameworks that can also interfere. And sometimes I also think drugs like metamizole, that is, you know, as a composite to butyl scopolamine, this is a drug that's also been reappraised a little. And that sometimes maybe is undervalued in practice for short-term pain relief. So the toolbox is bigger than we think sometimes.
And so also old tools can have new...
New deployment. Absolutely.
When it comes to then perceptions about pain, physiology, management, and so on, there's a lot of misconceptions. I mean, there has been old, as we call them, stable truths that has been going on, but also misconceptions from the veterinary world that kind of stays around a little bit. And for example, in the webinar on pain physiology, you mentioned the false idea of pain as an immobilizer. Something that seems to be sticking around, at least you hear it once in a while still. But what is the most common misconception, in your opinion, when it comes to equine pain in general?
Well, there's two. One pertains more to owners, one more to vet perceptions. One of the co-workers that I work with on a chronic pain project, Diana Howard, stated this at some point, and I thought it was so elegantly put. She said, why is that when a dog stops jumping in the trunk of the car, everybody will say, oh my gosh, there must be something wrong with Benji. He used to do this and now he's no longer doing this. He must be in pain. But when a horse doesn't jump the fence, they will think it's being cross or mischievous. And this is, it's really interesting that it must be due also to the human-animal bond and what we expect from it. But that I thought was a very good comment to make and very valid comment. So that might be one of the misconceptions, that we tend to not read equine behavior in as subtle a way or in as animal kind a way as we do with the dog, right? We will not consider that Benji just doesn't want to do it. We will think the dog is in pain. Of course, it used to always do this, but when the horse no longer does things that it normally did, you know, why is it being so difficult today? So I thought that was it might not always be valid, but I think it's an important comment to make. And then the other one pertains more to vet perceptions, where people tend to think, particularly if they've been in practice for a large number of years, when some drugs were maybe underutilized or not used at all out of certain fears, they'll be very reluctant to provide any more than an NSAID, even for quite invasive procedures or for quite moderate to severe pain. And, you know, sometimes the thing that would be cited was like, well, we always did it this way. Right? And I think when we go with, we always did it this way, I'm not saying more analgesics is always better, right? Definitely not. But we always did it this way. Well, we can also rank, you know, doing open heart surgery on a baby without analgesia under we always did it this way until the 80s. And just because we did or just because you can doesn't mean you should. And I think there's ample evidence that has been accrued over the past 10 to 20 years that shows that proactive pain treatment now can prevent alterations of the nervous system and these firing thresholds for years to come. So there are large incentives and good scientifically valid rationale to not minimize in terms of your strategy, but to say, okay, let's optimize this. And that doesn't mean optimize for any, you know, if it's mildly invasive, I'm going to bring in the big guns. No, if it's mildly invasive, you can do with a local block and an alpha 2 and you're fine. But if it's moderately to severe pain, then, you know, go up there. Don't hope for the best, because one of the best predictors of persistent post-surgical pain consistently in any human study is the severity of acute post-operative pain. So that is out of all possible predictors for chronic persistent pain. Obviously, pain level before the procedure also relates to it. But the severity of acute post-operative pain is the best independent predictor of chronic persistent pain. And if we know that, I think there's a really, really good rationale for you to want to optimize that treatment. And not say, oh, well, we used to do this on an NSAID, should be fine.
So, and also when it comes to your example with the dog not wanting to get in the car, is it, do you think it's a bit that we're more compassionate for small animals, or?
Well, it's actually interesting. There's been studies done that we spend much more time as well. The dog tends to be around you the whole time. And a horse, some people spend the whole day at the horse. I envy them. I would love to. But we spend typically chunks of time with them, but not whole days. And so there's a different animal-human relationship. I'm not saying it's any worse, this bond, right? It is. I mean, I've had my own horses. Absolutely in love with the horse. But we do have a difference, and there is just more. And it's good for us to realize that there are more hurdles to us interpreting horse behavior than there are to us interpreting dog behavior, possibly. The same holds true for cats. We know that people find it much harder to guesstimate pain in cats than they do in dogs. So there's personality parts there and closeness of how we can relate to something.
I'm sure the time you spent with them is a...
is a factor.
So are there any other myths that you would like to debunk when it comes to equine pain? I mean, there are a few of them. We've been debunking a few also in the webinars, but... are there any specific that you would take the opportunity to
opportunity to debunk? I suppose I already touched on how some studies that are done in healthy horses with dosages of analgesic drugs, you cannot one-on-one extrapolate to the painful situation. Why? Because a nervous system in a clinical pain state is a different nervous system altogether from one that is not experiencing afferent input. It's that simple. So we know that pain can affect GI motility. If we're going to look at GI motility impairment by analgesics, we should ideally, sure, we can start with healthy animals and see what happens, but then ideally we need to then confirm these data in a study where clinically painful animals are either treated with a drug or not, right? And then we look at GI motility issues. And I think that's an important thing where, for instance, in joint disease, very commonly people jump from the in vitro situation and say, oh, this drug seems to work on synovitis, or it works on the cartilage in a petri dish, so it will also work in the horse. Well, it's a it's a far cry, right? We're making a massive leap of faith there. I think for analgesia, the leap of faith is sometimes from the healthy horse situation, given a dose, to the clinical situation with a painful animal, maybe receiving multiple drugs at the same time, and pain progressing or regressing over time. So that, I think, is an important one. The other myth to debunk is definitely the reluctance sometimes to consider that instead of adding yet another drug or trying a higher dose of the same drug is going to get you this super response. So maybe it's the reality check sometimes where we are the guardians of the welfare of the horse, and that if we start to feel that it is unlikely that we're going to change the clinical condition of the horse enough for what it needs, that we do enter into the conversation with the owner. Because at the end of the day, the owners are concerned about their horse's welfare, and they want it to benefit from this treatment as much as you do. So it's important that you take them along, particularly for conditions that are as frustrating as recurrent colics, you know, these mild spasmodics that come back all the time, or osteoarthritis, where there is good periods and bad periods, and generally it's slowly progressive. If we pretend as though, you know, the next drug we try is going to be the cure or the fix, we're only creating an owner that starts to lose faith.
Yeah.
Right? We set ourselves up for failure and we lose the owner along the story. So I think it's important that we sometimes also are very honest about what current medicine can and cannot offer. And so for osteoarthritis, I mean, I always tell people, look in a drugstore. There's 50 bottles there with osteoarthritic drugs. Well, anti-osteoarthritic drugs. And then I always say, what we should take as a cue is apparently there is no cure for that pain. If any of those drugs was the answer, why would the other ones be around? And so I think it's important that vets also have the nerve and the take the time to talk to the owner about their expectation management. You will find general practitioners, so human GPs, doing this a lot.
Yeah.
When you come to them for a consultation, they'll ask you outright, what is your treatment question for me?
Yeah.
You know, what are you expecting from this? Yeah. And I think sometimes it's good to get the expectance, you know, just outspoken and explicit so that you can debunk the myths already.
Yeah. Then speaking of owners, owner compliance and owner vet communication isn't always that simple. And some would probably say that it's as much of an art form to communicate with owners as it is to treat the patient. But how can you as a vet help the clients, your clients, to recognize the pain in their horses in the best possible way? And so do you have like any keys to how to educate them the best, or any, you know, this always works, or, you know?
Well, I think obviously dealing with owners, I completely agree with you. I've worked in a store for all of my studies in medicine, and I always say working in a department store has been my best training for my vet career. Because I had to interact with a lot of different customers. Some are happy, some are satisfied, some not. You might have not have had anything to do with their discontent, but you have to deal with them. So I agree, that's definitely challenging. And so again, that's no one size fits all solution, right? I always tell owners this, or I always know. So obviously part of that comes to the vet being able to tune in to sort of the gut feeling undertone, the unspoken part of why an owner might not be picking up on some situation. So if you're in an outpatient setting, I would say if you see aspects that are truly concerning, then definitely there is always the feeling like, oh, but if I address this, this owner might be upset because they feel like I'm attacking them, right? And I'm saying they should do things differently. But not speaking out is also not an option. So I usually try and look at what's holding this person back. So I will literally tell them, look, I know that you have the best intentions for your horse, right? I am brought out here to try and help you best care for him. If I really see management aspects that need, you know, urgent remedying, I will point them out and I will try to be politically nice about them, but I will need to point them out because any of the other advice, you know, we know that 90% of what we say goes in one ear, out the other, right? So 10% sticks around, and you need to make sure that they're receptive to your message. So I'm not about smooth talking. Sometimes you have an owner who has very preconceived ideas about, look, when I have a pain in my foot or in my, you know, I have a headache, I don't take paracetamol, I don't take ibuprofen, I don't believe in these drugs, it's all rubbish, you know, it's polluting my system and I don't want this. Then they're very easy to project that upon to their horse. And obviously, who am I to say who they should, how they should treat their own pain? However, I can relate to them and say, oh, I can totally see where you're coming from, right? And it's always best if you don't need the analgesic drugs. However, you can decide that for yourself, where the limit is of what kind of pain you can still stand without taking any of these drugs. But it is, who are we to project that upon the horse, right? The horse doesn't have a voice. It cannot tell you that the same way. So I will try and work with them so that I understand and try to show understanding for their beliefs or their preconceived ideas about, you know, pain and analgesics, and then just work casually towards the, hey, but we are not talking about self-reported pain here, you know, making them aware. And sometimes I really pass them, you know, the websites tell them, look, you know, these are easily accessible sources if you wonder about what pain expressions look like in horses, or if you wonder what a management change can contribute to your horse's well-being. You know, whether it's trying to prevent cribbing or providing feed through slow feeders, and whatever it is, I try and just bring up these items in a non-confrontational way, because at the end of the day, the entire management would need to change. It's usually not just somebody's ground feeling towards analgesics that's something for you to work on. It might be something else. It might be, and sometimes you really through these talks come to, well, you know, I personally am suffering from chronic pain and this is what I experience. So sometimes when you scratch the surface with these owners, some story pops up that allows you to better understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
And that can then be the opening to, because if you just provide a folder or a brochure or a website, you know, they're unlikely to take that from you. But if you've made a connection, then they're much more likely to be open to the next message.
Yeah. So how much should we then, like, how is it suitable to leave, for example, a composite pain scale with a horse owner and ask them, can you please fill this out every day or every twice a day or
something? I usually check with an owner whether they are motivated to do so.
Yeah.
Right? So I tell them, look, this, particularly when a problem's been around for a while. So I initially tell them, look, this is going, this is not going to be, you see a pain specialist and now we're going to fix this.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3. Right? This might be a process of trial and error.
Yeah.
And if I want to know what works and what not, then we need to have good feedback.
Yeah.
You know your horse the best. It usually really helps if you say that right? Because as an owner, that's what you want to hear, but also because it's true.
Yeah.
They spend way more time with their horse in obstructed environments, right? They're not in a different or new novel environment like what would happen if the horse came to the clinic, right? They are a totally different personality sometimes then. So it's true. These owners see aspects of the horse. They see them every day or they see them consistently, and they are the best to tell what has changed. So that way I tell them if they're motivated, then I'm going to leave these pain scores for them to do. I do always use the ones that are meant for owner assessment. So we need to not underestimate that some people find medical terms hard to understand. And if they become poorly interpretable, then really the answers are as good as just talking to them, but you cannot put any value on the scores you get.
Yeah. So which condition would you say then is most difficult for a horse owner to recognize?
Well, I would say the ones that don't have as much external proof of what's going on, right? So a painful eye, usually when they have, when they develop blepharospasm or there is discharge, the owners are alerted to it. But until that point is reached, they might, this might go unnoticed for a while, right? Any condition that causes headaches, do we see them? Can we infer them from a horse? I'm not very sure. The horses I've seen that then develop neurological symptoms because they had a mass actually growing in the head. Those are the horses you put through CT and you wonder, how can it be that they never, you know, that, that they never expressed overt pain signs? So I think those are really hard when there's no external proof of, hey, there is something going on there and this is likely painful, right? Same goes for internal pain. So like visceral pain, how would we know unless the horse starts to be, you know, colicky? Then we can tell, but we would still be looking for the source. We've had a number of horses referred for colic signs, which actually had a myopathy. Or which had an intrathoracic problem rather than an intra-abdominal problem. So I think those are the hardest for owners to relate to. However, the severity of the signs in these visceral cases usually alerts them. And it's alarming enough for them to alert the vet. Whereas in the more chronic orthopedic cases where probably one of the hardest ones is the horse that is aging and is also suffering from orthopedic pain. Because what part of the decline of the horse is due to normal processes of aging and what part is due to the disease worsening? That's super hard. And sometimes you need to try them on an analgesic and see what the difference is. And then you say, if it was just age, I haven't just made it younger. Right? I've taken away its pain, but I haven't made the horse any younger.
Yeah, yeah.
So this wasn't just age. No. This was pain.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to tell, I guess, if
it is.
It's slowly progressing as well.
Exactly.
But and sometimes you hear about these really horror stories where you have opened up a mouth of a horse and realized this has been going on for years. This has been, this is not a new issue. These issues have been going on. And when fixed, there's a whole different horse.
It is so sad the number of times that you hear someone saying, or after you enucleate a painful eye.
Yes.
Right? Owners will, they will mind this procedure. And I totally understand. But when they then see the horse, 9 out of 10 says, oh, it's not as bad cosmetically. And oh my goodness, I have my horse back.
Yeah.
You know, it acts the way it used to. And then you just wonder about how long this horse has been in pain for unnecessarily. So I think in terms of the dental pain, it's super important that we put awareness out there that just as much as humans needing a dentist, horses need a dentist.
Yeah, yeah.
They need these checkups. And that's something, you know, just in times it helps to refer to yourself.
Yeah.
Say if you've ever had dental pain, you know how incessant that is, hard to ignore and how much you want to be relieved of it. Right. Yeah.
So one thing that is that we haven't touched upon in the webinars and during these talks, but I find really interesting is the effect of placebo. And I mean, that is something that we see in human medicine a lot, and we also talk about it a lot in human medicine. But how is it then in animal medicine and in horses? What's your experience and your thoughts about that?
Well, that's a really, really super interesting topic indeed, also for analgesic research, right? So the placebo effect, does it play in veterinary medicine? Yes, it does, but it plays in different ways. So there is evidence to suggest that animals themselves can come to associate a certain formulation of a drug with a response, and they will show the response even if the active ingredient isn't in there. That's interesting. They will keep getting it, right? We were discussing this. The other thing that is interesting is an owner placebo effect, right?
Yeah.
So again, there's this extra layer that comes in veterinary medicine where the observer might have preconceived ideas about, hey, this is really helping.
We
started giving the treatment and my animal is getting better. So there is a number of studies that will show that the owner assessment of the dog or the horse is improving, even though the objective assessment or the force plate analysis for lameness, for instance, doesn't really show an improvement. The other aspect there is time, obviously.
Yeah.
This isn't a static condition. It's a condition that, you know, evolves over time. It either progresses or it regresses, but there's an evolution. And so very commonly, and this is true for any animal that we start treating, if it has improved since we started the treatment, is that because of the treatment or in spite of, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's very tempting to think, it must be what I gave him.
Yeah.
But I had a very experienced, an older colleague who would always say, well, you know, I still wonder what would have happened if we had just leaned back and given it corn syrup instead. And I think there's a valid comment to make there that sometimes we're attributing more to the treatment that we're given, that we're giving, others than, you know, the effect of time and the natural evolution of a certain event. But certainly, the placebo effect is something that's there. I've done some placebo controlled trials. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Those horses showed absolute response to the active and not to the placebo.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we know that these mechanisms of coming to expect a certain effect and then being able to call that up in your own body or in your immune system, I think it's only testimony to the incredible, powerful abilities of the mind and of the nervous system to influence bodily functions. And we're only at the brink of finding out more about that.
And I mean, you can't have any expectations if you're a horse and you don't know what to expect, sort of. No one has told you. But if you make the connection between an active ingredient and something that you are going to keep doing, like corn syrup, maybe.
Exactly.
Then you have another situation, because then you have an expectancy, sort of.
Yes, if you train them in a positive reinforcement way. Yeah. So it's sort of like operant conditioning,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the classical conditioning. Then there is a likelihood that indeed we could see the same sorts of effects that have previously been noted in rats, and also in humans, that we could see them in horses or dogs.
Very
well.
Interesting.
Really
so
cool.
I guess we're going to have to do these talks again in 10 years when
it would
we've
be
had
brilliant.
Lots of new research and studies being made.
It would be wonderful to harness those effects, yes.
But until then, I'm going to say thank you very much, Jonny, for coming here to Copenhagen, to our office here at Boehringer Ingelheim, and for giving us these presentations and these podcast interviews. Very nice to have you here.
Well, the pleasure was all mine. Thanks.
Thank you.